didn't quite hit the draft limit at Tyee. Followed it up into July, and then in the middle of July, it started to break over. And that's when we started drafting, and we got into a serious drought condition, or starting to move from, I think we were in a D1, and then into a D2 drought condition. This year, this right here, in this area down here at the bottom, is where we had a diesel campaign in Petersburg and Wrangell. It lasted about 6 weeks. So you see the line is about flat there, and then we've been recovering basically right exactly similar to what last year's guide curve looked like. Mm-hmm. Going to Swan Lake, like I mentioned, we're at 299.9, so not 297.6. Let me go back on that one. Very similar curve to, at Swan Lake last year as there was at Tyee. I wanted to kind of make note of this. Diesel campaign in 2018, there in the winter or early spring months. And then there in the middle of July, same kind of thing, Tyee or Swan Lake again to draft, and rainfall didn't come. So both lakes drafted, and we were drafting them evenly, utilizing low tables and doing what the organization would do to try and prevent the rate of draft. Section 3.0 goes into rainfall. So looking at this chart, this is 100 years of rainfall. You might ask, why not Petersburg or Wrangell? Well, why pick Ketchikan for rainfall? And the reason is because NOAA has 100 years of accurate rainfall for Ketchikan. So that's kind of what we use to try and get, hey, what's the long-term trend? What's it look like for Southeast Alaska? On average, it's about 150 inches of rain for 100 years. But you can see there's a lot below that, and this is in 1938, for example, and then lots above that. So sometimes you could have upwards of 100 and nearly 190 inches of rain, and then times you've had where you've had 96 inches of rain. So that it is very has a lot of deviance to it. Looking at this a little closer, especially in this 20-year period here between 1978 and 1998. We have this area here, late 1990s, where in 1996 we got 108 inches of rain. The very next year, we got 165. So we were in a drought, and then we began, if we didn't draft the lakes, we'd have spilled like crazy. All that water that we would have spilled if we didn't draft the lakes as much as possible and maximize utilization would have been lost. And which could have been used in 1998, when the very next year we only got 102 inches. So the idea here is, you have a drought year, it's not uncommon to see huge discrepancies year to year in these era, these periods of what I'm going to be getting into, Pacific Decadal Oscillation period, where you have almost 60 inches of change year to year. Looking at section 4.0 is our inflow forecast section. This is typical NOAA. For those that follow NOAA outlooks, this is a three-month outlook for NOAA for the months of June, July, and August of 2019. This was created on May 16th. But looking at this, we can see that the panhandle here in majority of Alaska is seeing with a high probability of above average temperatures. We're seeing for mainland Alaska above average probability for above average precipitation. But looking here for us, down here in Southeast Alaska, they're giving it an equal chance. And that means 33% chance that it could be above, 33% chance that it could be average, or 33% chance it could be below. So it's pretty much hands in the air, we don't know.
That's what we have to work with.
Some of the ways we look at forecasting in the future is to take a look at El Nino and La Nina. And we hear this term all the time, and it has a significant impact on precipitation. El Nino typically will cause increased precipitation, and La Niñas will cause decreased precipitation. And the important thing to remember there is that the ocean is a big place, and so a few degrees in centigrade above an average is going to cause evaporation to be significantly different. So you'll get significantly more rain when you're above average temperatures or below. Just looking at this a little bit and explaining this chart, what you have on the side here is an actual zero would be if they measured the ocean for 10,000 years, what's its average temperature? Zero is average. This would be 1 degree above average, 2 degrees above average, or similarly below average. And looking out in the future, we're still in a moderate El Nino. We're not quite, we've been up in here in the 2.0 range, 2017, 2016 timeframe. But we're in a moderate El Nino, so you would think we'd be getting rain, or at least getting moderate rain. But that's not the case, and we'll kind of go into that here next. But I want to show you what that looks like for an El Nino. It's really a measurement of the water at the equator. So this is a lot of ocean. Again, you know, if you were to be at home and you were to heat up a pot of water on your stove, and it's just before boiling, it's going to have a little bit more steam to it or evaporation than water that's sitting at cool temperature. So the warmer the ocean is, and the larger that area is on the sea surface temperature, the more likely that's probably going to evaporate. So in a cooling trend, in El Nino, you'll see this large area there at the equator, and it actually affects southeast Alaska with some warming along the Pacific coast and up into Alaska. And then on the La Niña here, you would have this trend. So you would, typically when we have this El Nino, we get lots of precipitation here in the States. But the challenge is trying to understand what this effect is. So we saw that in the El Nino La Niña, we saw that belt there at the equator of warming and cooling temperatures. But in a Pacific Decadal Oscillation, there's actually a measure of a temperature up here in the North Pacific, and that's that water's out here. So in a positive PDO, which I would have named this differently, but in a positive PDO, you'll have warm waters along the coast or in the Gulf of Alaska, where you'll have this very large body of cool water out in the major part of the ocean. So a significant area here of cool water. And then in a negative PDO, you actually have a significant area of warm water. Taking a look at PDO, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and ENSO models, which is the El Nino and La Niña, I put together this chart here, and I think I explained this at the last board meeting, but we're going to go into a little more detail on it. Basically, this chart is showing is 100 years of rain in Ketchikan is the green line. And then the blue line would be every time you see a blue spike or below or above would be zero is that average ocean temperature. The blue is the El Nino La Niña, so the temperature of the ocean down at the equator. And then the orangish, reddish is that Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which would be the temperatures up here in the northern Pacific. Taking a close look at this though, so let's take a look from 1948 to 1978. We were in considered a cold phase PDO. And what you can see here is there's a lot more orange below zero than there is above zero. Now, talking about El Niños and La Niñas, you can see that an El Nino does affect the temperatures in the Pacific Ocean here. But what you can see is if we're in a cold phase, and we're above average, typically way up here above the average in rain, if we get a La Niña, it will drive the rains down. An El Nino will drive the rains back up. So what this is showing is that a cold phase PDO raised the average rainfall above 150 inches, and then a warm phase PDO will actually lower it. Taking a look at warm phase, 1978 to 1998, about a 20-year span there, you can see the average rain was all below average 150. This is 150 right here. All this middle line is either 150 inches of rain or average temperatures. You can see we had, we will have years of times in that time period, years where we go above average, but that significantly correlates with whether or not it's an El Nino year. So if we have this warm phase PEO, we're typically below here, our average line changes, and we shift year to year based on an El Nino and La Nina. Looking at the last 20 years up until 2018, similar pattern to 1948 to 1978, we had above average rainfalls, 160, 170 inches, and we were real flush, spilling many of those years. And that's why consideration I mentioned earlier was not as a big a concern for the operations plan, I think, because when you're spilling, it's not as big a concern on how efficiently you operate. But now, I've got some confirmation from NOAA. Last time I spoke with the board, I think I said that I was working with NOAA on this. I got some confirmation from NOAA that they do see some correlation, but they can't confirm some of these outliers. Like, for example, in this period of time, why did we go below average here? And I think that has to do with they're not correlating with the La Nina that happened. But that's still, they're still trying to develop models for Southeast Alaska. Taking a look here, an email that I received and been going back and forth with NOAA, Aaron Jacobs, and in particular, Rick Tolman for the Alaska Center of Climate in Fairbanks. He sent me an email and he said, here's a plot of the 12-month running Ketchikan precip versus the 12-month running mean PEO. That's the NCI version as you use. He stated that even just eyeballing this shows times of good correspondence between high PEO, low precipitation, or low PEO and high precipitation, for example, in the 70s and mid-late 90s. He says the overall correlation is 0.27, which is certainly non-trivial. The precip to PEO correlation is significantly increased at lead times of 15 to 25 months, but unfortunately, that means we would need good PEO forecasts out that far. So what he was saying is, we have good El Nino and La Nina forecasts, but they do not have good PEO forecasts. So for them to give us better than an equal chance, they just can't do it because the forecasting is not there for PEO. Now that we've moved into this, and if we're in this trend and they confirm that we're in a PEO, then the forecasting gets easier because now you've got another 20 years trend cycle that you can work with. But when you make that shift from one 20-year to 30-year cycle to the next, really trying to figure out what's coming tomorrow is the most challenging part for NOAA and climatologists. Take a look at it. He charted it similar to what I did. You can see where the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, if it's low, you got high rainfalls. This is precipitation in Ketchikan, Alaska, versus PEO. And then you'll see times where when the it's vice versa. One thing that he was mentioning with the correlation factor is sometimes they're on top of each other, where PEO and precip is together. And that's where I mentioned that's the years where you have the large El Ninos. So I think that's the next stage in their development of their models, is to take into consideration the equator and sea surface temperatures down there, and how that large area of ocean actually has impacts and effects on the on Southeast Alaska. Any questions on that? I'd like to stop there for a second, because that's all of that is basing our info. What is going to base our info forecast? It's predicting loads is really easy. We have historical loads, we know exactly pretty much to within megawatts what the loads are going to be today, tomorrow, and in a month or two. But we don't know what the rain's going to be. And so we have to make a prediction on that. Anybody have any questions on the forecast, the inflow forecast or the PDOs or INSOs or anything like that? Okay, we'll move on. Using that, all that information that we just went through, pick two inflow cases. First of all, we used 2018, because 2018 is the worst we've seen in 20 years, and so that would be the low inflow case. Then I took the average of 1994 to 1999, because as you've seen, we had that 1996, 97, 98 seasons where you had below average rainfalls, and then you had some closer to average rainfalls. This is what that inflow sequence I considered our average case, and 2018 I considered our low case. And I took all the, I grabbed all that inflow data that we have on file, and we figured out how that inflow, all how those inflows are going to come for Taiyi and Swan Lake. And the way it turns out, for 2018, Swan Lake would have 314.9 CFS if we got a repeat of 2018. And if we had an average of 1994 to 99, Swan Lake would have 319.1 CFS on average. Taiyi, similarly, in 2018, they'd have 106.5 if we had a repeat of last year. And if we have the average of 94 to 99, they'll have 115. This is what's used in the model. These values right here is what's used in the model. They determine how the lake's going to respond to the amount of load that we put to each unit. Looking at load forecasts, Ketchikan, we expected if we had all the available hydro to provide their firm power requirements, we would expect them to be around 99,716 megawatt hours for their firm power requirements. Unfortunately, the Swan Lake models are showing that Swan Lake only has capacity to produce around 38,832. So the difference is going to have to be made up somehow. At this point, it looks like because the STI and there is not available additional dedicated at Taiyi to shift power across the STI, that additional that we talked about that needs to be made up from Swan Lake is most likely going to have to be made up by supplemental diesel in Ketchikan. Petersburg and Wrangell estimate their firm power requirements to be 90,463.2, and we expect Taiyi to produce 90,463.2. As you see when we build the models, and that will leave about 20 to 30 feet in Taiyi Lake. We don't expect any extended outages. Section 6.0, the iterative map model with the, now that we've showed you how we do it, showed you what we actually use, I just showed you the inflows that we are using, the loads that we're using for the model. Our assumptions and the inputs include, Taiyi will not have capacity to provide additional dedicated output. We don't expect it to, unless the rains change and we start seeing a significant amount of rain. And we don't forecast that there will be additional dedicated output, at least for this next 6 months. Two inflow cases used, the 94.99 average case and the 2018 inflow case. And then average 5-year historical loads were used, as we've just displayed. And again, no extended CEBA outages were expected, just a standard annual outage. When we talk about extended outages, it would be something above and beyond a week. If we're talking a month or something, that would significantly impact the member utilities. But our outages are typically a week to 10 days. With all the inputs and discussions we've had, we create the models. Looking at the Swan Lake model, in order to, because there's not enough capacity in Swan Lake to provide all the firm power requirements of Ketchikan, in order to modulate Swan Lake and keep it from staying at the draft limit and not having any water in it all year, we have to limit its output. So looking at this, if you have the 1994 to 99 base megawatt case that we talked about, the green bar would be how many megawatts on average could Swan Lake produce. That would be approximately 6 for this period, and then for this period in here, it'd be about 8. So July to nearly December, we'd be able to produce 8 megawatts, and then after that, we'd be able to produce 6. That's if we've got 1994 to 99 average rate. Looking at what we have, we're looking like we're close to repeating 2018. So if the repeat of 2018 occurs, which it seems to be, Swan Lake would have to be modeled in a manner with this gray bar graph, where we have approximately an output of 4 megawatts for a period of time, down to 3, and then in September, may have to actually turn the unit off, and then once the rains start to come in October, late October, mid-October, then we would be able to utilize the units to a larger capacity. What this does, though, is by inputting those into the model, you can see that what the lake levels, how they respond. So the blue is 2018. If we input the gray bar graphs and actually operate Swan Lake in that manner, this is how the Swan Lake will respond. And if we do it using the green bar graphs, which would be the 94 to 99, you can see the red line. So the intent here was to try and make it so that we stayed below 300, but we also stayed above 280. And you can see we dipped down a couple times close to 280 as we moved throughout here. So it's trying to make it through the rainy season and make it through the drier parts of the drought and capture the rainy seasons before we hit the draft line so that we can keep Swan Lake in operation. In section 6.2, kind of talking on Swan Lake and with Ketchikan, we looked at putting in how supplemental diesel would be integrated into the system. This is actually complements of KPU, this graph, thank you, Andy. This was their original intent on how they would like to operate. At first, it was considered a little too aggressive, but CIPA and KPU met on multiple occasions, and we agree that this plan should work just fine. Looking at this, the way this works is at 290 feet when Swan Lake is falling, we begin discussing what's the lake's going to look like, which we do every Tuesday anyways, but we'd be discussing it more further on whether or not a diesel campaign would be suitable. At elevation 286, the operations plan states that KPU may use diesel generation to actually augment the draft rate of Swan to try and lessen the steepness of this curve. And so supplemental diesel generation and Swan Lake would all be in the mix until Swan Lake reaches elevation 280. And the intent is here to reach elevation 280. Because if we don't reach 280, and let's say we only reach 286, and we actually come up here and spill, all this water you see down here would be part of that spill and be lost.
Yeah.
And that's lost sales, lost energy, and just wasted water. On the rising period, once we hit the elevation 280, Swan Lake would be turned off. And all generation in Ketchikan would be performed by diesel generation or local hydros. And Swan Lake would remain off until we reach an elevation of 288. And then we would turn on Swan Lake, and it would be running fully isochronous or the full firm power requirements of Ketchikan would be met. Challenges is this year we're already above 280. We're at elevation 300 as we sit today. So that being said, we're even above this green and we're up there at 300. We've been working with KPU on that issue, on that concern, because if it rains from today forever, or for the next 6 months, for example, and it just starts raining like it did in 1997 after the 96 drought, it just comes on like that and it doesn't stop. And that's how it happens. But if we were to do that, at 300 feet, we wouldn't be able to draft it anymore, and we would lose all of that water. And so if you think about what 300 feet is, it's about 20 feet of water, or 8,000 megawatt hours. It's quite a bit of energy. So we have been kind of riding Swan Lake right there at about between the 290 and 300, only because we don't have much concern for that rain turning on like that. If we see it in the forecast, though, we're going to try and draft this thing, and I want to make that clear. We're going to try and follow this chart. We're going to try and draft that lake and capture that rain, because if we don't, we could go from that yearly ship like we've seen so many times, you know, and as I showed, and we wouldn't be able to capture that rain.
So, Robert?
Yes, sir.
Back to that chart, if you would, please. So if we're presently at 300, we're not generating out of Swan. We're not really following what the plan is here, right? So if we started drafting now at 300, and we're still in a rising situation, we would continue until what we drafted the lake to the 290?
Or so ideally, if we were today, and we're at elevation 300, and Swan has 20 feet above the draft limit and has 28 feet above the perk limit, 28 feet of water, 28 and a half feet of water in Swan Lake. If we were to start and follow the plan, we would turn off diesels completely in Ketchikan. Swan Lake would provide all the perk power requirements of Ketchikan, and we'd begin drafting approximately half a foot to a foot a day with no rain, if there was no rain at all. If we get an inch of rain, then we don't draft at all. If we get a half an inch rain, then we draft a half a foot. For example, once we hit the 290, then the supplemental diesel would come on, and we would run all the cats and try and supplement Swan Lake. And then once you got down to 286, once you got to 286, that's when you would run the supplement. And then once you got down to 280, then Swan Lake would turn off. Now, the intent here is if we're making a turn. This is for a turn. So if the snowpack is coming off the hill, for example, or the inflow forecast is showing that, yeah, we're not indeed in a warm phase specific to Kittle oscillation now in the fluke. This drop is over, and you can see it on the horizon that what we just got for rain doesn't stop, and Swan Lake's, you know, it's gonna fill. We want to do this. We draft that thing down and try and capture that rain.
We're not seeing that right now because you're still thinking there's probably the next 10 days is showing still dry and warm, correct?
Next 10 days or so, absolutely. Absolutely, 10 days, 14 days, dry and warm. And I still think we're not there yet either. This might not be in effect until next draft season.
So, but...
Or we not, might not.
In modifying that, how do you figure now about the generation, since Swan is off right now, right? We're not running Swan right now.
Swan's running.
During the day.
Swan has been running.
It's off right now. It's just...
I'll get into that, how we're operating Swan right now.
Okay, okay.
Swan,
yeah.
I think, has been following that 2018 guide curve. The 2018...
Sure. Robert, just for a moment, I see some people getting up and walk around with it. We need to take about a 5-minute break. Are you guys all okay?
Okay.
Everybody all right? All right. Go ahead, Professor.
Right now, Swan's operating at about the 4-megawatt range right here.
So, you brought out the, you tickled out the right question, and that's why you turned it. So,
yeah.
We know we're going to be dry for months, so we're not pushing that fact right now, but we would be pushing for it.
Go ahead. We're okay.
Swan Lake's running at about 4 megawatts, but it's operating at max capacity or max efficiency. So we only run it half the time or less than half the time. Right, so if I were to turn Swan Lake on and run it at 4 megawatts and just leave it, you'd be dumping 20% or 15% of the water right out the tail end.
Yeah.
Like just wasting it. You may as well be spilling it. So in order to make this 4 megawatt average, this is average, you would run it at its efficiency level for a certain period of time during the day.
Shorter period. High efficiency,
but yeah. Max efficiency. Then you maintain the lake level. You maximize everything out of that water that you can possibly get. You extend, and I'll get into this, but for example, if you can only operate for 10 months on Swan Lake, by doing it this way, you could operate for 11 months. Right? So it would buy you a whole month over a 10-month period if you gain 10% in efficiency. And that's what we're doing. And we'll get into that here in a little bit.
Okay.
Exactly.
We just kind of started doing that days ago.
So those are kind of the charts there. I mean, typically we're able to see a chart from Swan Lake that looks similar to Tyee, and that's because